Like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries to order. Today is the 21st of January, Martin Luther King Day. It is approximately 8:40. And we have, we don't have a quorum yet. We're having an overview today, so we're not considering a bill so that we can start. We have several people that are excused or in other meetings. And so President, our Representative Johansson, Representative Edgman, myself, Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, and Representative Holmes are in a HESS Finance Subcommittee, and they'll join us when that is over, and Representative Ledoux is excused. And Representative Johnson is on his way. So at this time, I'd like to remind everybody about their cell phones. And yes, Representative Johansson.
Well, just before Ms. Andrews begins, I'd like to ask a real quick question if you're finished.
Not quite, but we can go ahead.
Yeah, well, go ahead and finish and then before she starts.
Today we will hear an overview from the Alaska Department Fish and Game Subsistence Division. That's Director Elizabeth Andrews. Next week we will be hearing HB 41, move of the Habitat Division from DNR to ADF&G. And overviews on weather vane scallop management and mariculture management in Alaska, and that would be HB 16 as well. So Representative Johansson, did you have?
Yeah, just to preface the entire presentation, what is the percentage of the overall piece of the pie when we're talking about harvesting, commercial, sports, subsistence, etc.? What portion of the pie is your subsistence presentation going to be talking about? Is it 3% of the overall take, 20%? Can you just preface it by letting me know?
Chairman Seaton, Representative Johansson, it would be around 2%. Okay. When we consider all fish and wildlife.
Thank you.
And it varies, of course, area by area. So, for example, I was just last week at the Board of Fisheries meeting in Kodiak, and the subsistence fished harvest in that area is roughly less than 1% of the total commercial and sport.
But overall, about 2%
yeah.
is what we're talking about.
That's the ballpark figure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions before we get started with the presentation? Thank you. Director Andrews, would you go ahead? And welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Seaton and committee members, for this opportunity to speak to you about our program. As mentioned, my name's Elizabeth Andrews, and I'm the director of the Subsistence Division. I do have the handout there, and you can follow along there. Or unfortunately, you've got your backs to it. I understand in some of the other rooms they have the screens elsewhere. Just want to mention, some of this may be a review from last year. Some parts will sound familiar to some of you. I wanted to first mention our for the State Subsistence Division, our mission and purpose. In 1978, that's when the Alaska statute first recognized the economic and cultural importance of wildlife in the lives of Alaskans and passed the law. This provided a priority for customary and traditional uses for subsistence. I'll talk about that a little more shortly. And it preceded the 1980 federal law, ANILCA, in part so that the state could retain management authority over all lands.
And if I might just interrupt you and recognize that we've been joined by Representative Johnson, and we do have a quorum for the meeting. Thank you.
Good morning. Our mission as a division in the department has four basic elements. It's to gather information on subsistence uses, it's to quantify it, evaluate it, and report that information. And it includes both fisheries and wildlife. What are subsistence uses? What are subsistence uses? They're the non-commercial, customary, and traditional uses. That's different from personal use because it has a customary and traditional component that each board of fisheries and board of game has to identify. The Alaska regulations since statehood and preceding the state subsistence law did provide for subsistence fishing. It didn't just come with the 1978 statute, but the priority did. Fisheries resources are important to Alaskans, and this includes subsistence fisheries. And in fact, in many communities, the fish harvests for subsistence account for anywhere from a third to two-thirds of the total food harvest. Again, that varies by area. It's marine fisheries as well as freshwater fisheries.
Ms. Andrews?
Yes.
If I might just back up. So basically then in some areas, such as on the Yukon River, I would presume, then the in those areas, the subsistence harvest may be much higher than the commercial or the sport harvest combined, even is what. Is that what you're saying? Are there particular areas of the state where that applies versus areas where the sport harvest is larger or where the commercial harvest is larger?
Well, certainly, Mr. Chairman, certainly along the Yukon, for example, as well as the Kuskokwim, where the commercial harvests have diminished considerably, the subsistence harvests can often be greater, you know, for at least for fisheries, but in the whole suite of all of the resources, as I said, it'll range between a third and two-thirds around the state. But that is an example. For example, with Chinook salmon, it's greater on the Kuskokwim and Yukon for subsistence catches. But again, there's very little commercial fishing as a result of changes in run strength and so forth over the years.
And does that also apply for different species? Like, I know sheafish is quite important, I think, in some of the areas of the state. I'm not quite as familiar as I wish I was with those fisheries. But is there a commercial and a sport fishery on those species as well? And how important would that be, salmon versus non-salmon fisheries resource?
Mr. Chairman, again, that does vary by area. For example, like with sheafish, that is particularly significant in parts of the northwest Arctic areas. And there's really small commercial. There's a permit that sometimes the department issues for commercial. There's certain streams that are important for sport fisheries for sheafish. But by and large, in those areas, you know, the majority of the sheafish take would be for subsistence uses.
So the one-third to two-thirds is predominantly looking at salmon, is that, or is that
that's taking everything statewide. So when you take fish and wildlife, salmon, non-salmon, combine it all together, the proportion is you know, in the grand scheme of things, is relatively small. But as you point out, you're correct. I mean, it'll vary area by area and by what the species is.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. In terms of our program, our mandate's to conduct applied research. So we're not the management divisions, commercial fisheries and sport fisheries are the management divisions, but it's to conduct the applied research and to provide the information for implementing the state subsistence law. We prioritize the work so that basically we're doing two things, and these tie into our core services, and that's to provide the information to the boards, whether it's fisheries or game, so that they can provide a reasonable opportunity for subsistence uses. And it's also to provide the information to the managers so that it factors into the overall management of the fish stocks or populations. As I mentioned, subsistence fishing management is handled by the management divisions, commercial fisheries and sport fisheries. They also have their own research arms, but we do the research on subsistence uses, again, whether it's fisheries or wildlife. In 1990, as I know many of you are aware, the management of subsistence fishing became more complex with the federal government beginning to manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and at that time, fishing in non-navigable waters. In 1999, they then added management on all federal public lands and waters within their jurisdiction.
Representative Johansson.
I'm not sure how long you've been with the division, but how has your role changed with the 1990 and 1999 changes?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson. I had been with the division for roughly 18 years, and then I left and was doing some other kinds of work, and then came back 2 years ago. Some of the things that are the same are that we do the subsistence research. The federal programs don't do research. They're involved in the management, and they have a whole regulatory arm that deals with what you might hear about in terms of the regional advisory councils. A lot of it's focused on that. They get funding, which is for open competitive bidding. Different divisions in the department, commercial fisheries, sport fish, as well as our division, as well as private businesses bid on that money for certain projects to get contracts. So they don't do the research themselves. So that stayed the same. We are the basic research entity in the state. In terms of management, that would be a good question to pursue with the managers who have had considerable challenges when the federal programs try to extend jurisdiction. They have regulations that don't align with the state's regulations, so that poses not only enforcement but management problems. In terms of our division, again, it's we're just getting the information on the subsistence uses regardless of where those uses occur. The challenge for us is staying on top of reviewing all the proposals that go before the federal program. Our priority is to review and analyze all the ones that go before the state boards of fisheries and games, and so we've stuck with that, and our review has, in terms of the federal ones, has diminished, and pretty much there's a handful of folks in the department that take the lead on that. So in the past, we used to take the lead on that, but we don't take the lead on that now, although we do contribute to it and review what they put together.
Follow-up, Representative Johansson.
So where is your, can you characterize and tell me where your input point is? Do you sit on, does the Division of Subsistence sit in a room with the federal folks and you have a chance to talk about it, or where is your specific interaction with the people who are making the decisions, and do you feel like you have an impact on what's going on with their decisions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, the point person for the department is one of the special assistants to the commissioner. That position gathers the information from the different divisions and has a couple of staff that prepare that information. We have a staff person that's part of that team. There's people from each of the divisions, and it's called the liaison team for the department, and there's a chair of that group, which currently is one of the special assistants to the department, although we're recruiting right now for an assistant director that leads that team. So we're one part of that team. The team leader determines whether the leader is going to go and interact directly with the federal staff, or whether there's other staff that go to the federal staff meetings to discuss the proposals with them. And same thing at the federal board meeting. The department has a seat there. It's the commissioner or the commissioner's designee. The chair of the liaison group is usually at that, and then whatever support staff are needed to speak to specific proposals attend. And we do have a seat on the department's team.
One final question.
Follow-up, Representative Johansson.
I know back in the '90s, when I was around here, subsistence was a big, big issue. I know this is a giant can of worms, but is there, what is the position from the administration on either wanting to go back to prior to 1999, so you have more control over it, or is it just, this is the way it is, and there's no intention from the administration to go back and revisit the '99 decisions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, I'm not aware if there are, if there is interest in trying to either revisit ANILCA or make other changes to the subsistence law. The approach that we've been taking the last couple of years as a department and the state, and we've been working with Department of Law on this, is to continue to challenge any regulations or decisions that we as a state think are inappropriate and aren't demonstrated by substantial evidence. And I'm sure Department of Law at some point could come and speak to the committee about some of those requests for reconsiderations. There's a lawsuit on the wildlife side and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And before you proceed on, I just wanted to get some clarification. We're talking about your division is predominantly or exclusively research, not management. And you said that research was also done by the Sport Fish Division and the Commercial Fish Division, as well as managing. Now, is there a differentiation between that research? I mean, is the research from sport and commercial basically looking at stock assessments, and then yours is utilization and the need assessments, or can you kind of just break those apart and so that we understand the basis of those research?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the main point is that the other divisions, whether it's commercial fisheries, sport fisheries, and wildlife for that matter, they have management and research functions, whereas our division only has a research function. So in the big scheme of things, that's how it works. In terms of specific projects, you're correct. I mean, it's enumeration, stock assessment. They are responsible for example, harvest monitoring, including subsistence, and we do obtain funds through a reimbursable services agreement in some areas, and we lead that research. In other areas, Commercial Fisheries Division does it.
But your division doesn't, even on some of the non-commercial species or, let's say, sheepfish or something, your division doesn't do stock assessment and determining the level at which harvest is going to be allowed. Your division looks at what the need in the community is and what the utilization is. Is that pretty much it?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I mean, we do the human uses aspect of it. What's taken, what are the patterns of use, what's the timing, the geographic areas that are used, and then that feeds into the management programs when they make decisions on what's the allowable harvest. That's entirely with the biologists and the management divisions. And then, of course, the boards makes the allocation decisions.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's see, just moving to this one, subsistence opportunity and subsistence preference, and this kind of follows along with what we were just talking about. It is the Board of Fisheries that implements the state law by providing the reasonable opportunity for subsistence fishing. And so this is not a guarantee of amount of fish or unlimited fishing time, but it's what's considered reasonable considering the customary patterns of use. That's the opportunity aspect of the subsistence statute. And the preference aspect is that only when it's necessary to restrict harvest does the Board of Fisheries provide a preference over other uses. Up until that point, all uses are provided for.
Okay, Representative Joyance.
How many times has that actually happened, your last bullet point there?
Has there been a harvest restricted and preference given to a subsistence user in the last few years?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, it can happen from time to, you know, from season to season, or it could be a regulation. For example, in the most extreme example is in the Nome salmon fishery, where at one time it was what was called a Tier 2 subsistence fishery. Commercial fishing had closed years ago. Stocks still weren't doing well. Sport fishing had been cut back. Escapements were really poor, and they had to restrict even among the subsistence uses. So it gets ratcheted down. For example, on the Yukon River, the management plan, for example, like with chum salmon, in the management plans, it lays out at what point there will be restrictions. So at a certain point, there'll be cutbacks on commercial, and then there'll be no commercial. Then there'll be cutbacks in sport fish, and then there'll be no sport fish. Then there'll be cutbacks in subsistence fishing. Now, during the course of this, there can still be cutbacks in subsistence fishing time, for example, provided that the board determines that, given the conservation concerns, there's still some reasonable opportunity. But conservation will always trump subsistence opportunities. So it becomes a ratcheting down.
Can I rephrase the question?
Yes, in just a moment. And like Representative Holmes has joined us from the other committee. Representative Johansson.
In the past, say, just for reference, 4 or 5 years, has a commercial or sport fishery been cut back or cut off to provide a subsistence use in the last few years?
Well, there were, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, there were some of the years in the early 2000s when, for example, on the Yukon and I think the Kuskokwim, there was another salmon disaster, really poor escapements. Those are examples where it was the run assessment very early on, for example, at the pilot station sonar would show that the run wasn't materializing, and so they wouldn't even open commercial fishing. They would go into the season not opening it. I'd have to, you know, talk to the managers and find out exactly, you know, which years and how many fisheries that occurred on.
Okay.
But
that,
we do.
That wasn't the year they had the sonars upside down, was it? Sorry. Anyway.
You were specifically asking about fish, not wildlife. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, I actually.
Okay.
But, you know, if there's cases in wildlife, that'd be interesting to hear about, too.
Well, I think there is some. It'd be interesting to get into discussion on the up above Galena on the Koyukuk River. I know that there's been a kind of a pretty drastic change in the allocation and restrictions on some of the harvest there versus, you know, the necessity for the subsistence harvest in the local area. So we could talk about some of those in a minute. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate where Representative Johansson is going, but I would like to see a report on that in writing to the committee of number of times that our areas are, and without being terribly specific and taking a lot of man hours, just how many times sports and commercial fishing was closed to subsistence. So if we could just get a, you know, 1 year, this spot, doesn't need to be real fancy, nothing, but just I'd like to know how many times and where that's happened in, say, 5 years. Would that work for you, Representative Johansson?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah, I'd like to know the real number.
Director Andrews, is that kind of a report possible? And it doesn't have to be all inclusive. What we're trying to get is a feeling for that. But the I'm trying to also find what parameter you want, whether you want fisheries that were open and closed, or whether there are fisheries such as was just talked about where the commercial fishery didn't open that year, and the determination had been made that they weren't going to have a commercial fishery. Do you want that included as well?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think, you know, you talked about scaling back, and I think anytime you had to scale back, either cutting out sports or cutting out commercial, or scale back, and that probably broadens the report considerably. I don't want this to be a long, I don't want this to take a lot of man hours. I would just kind of, 10 times in the last 5 years, we've had to scale back commercial or sports fishing in this area. I don't want to get into a huge man hour report, just something very, shouldn't be too tough to get if you just keep it simple. So.
And this is what I want to get the committee's request a little clearer on, so that we're not looking for every single place in the state that they, but some examples in the last 5 years. And I want to know from Director Andrews, what's a reasonable request from us to you for this this project? Like I say, we're not asking for something comprehensive and exclusive.
Mr. Chairman, again, I would have to pitch that to the directors of the other two divisions who you heard from the other day, Director Hilsinger and Swanton, because they're the ones that do the management. I guess I would also mention, you know, that it's their determination in season with their management authority as to what the assessment of the runs are. And as I said, typically there's management plans and regulations that lay out how this may occur, you know, the ratcheting down, and what they need as indicators before they go to restrictions, and how you ratchet down in order to still be able to, at the last resort, provide some subsistence opportunity, unless in some extreme cases that, you know, they close subsistence fishing altogether.
And I guess this is why I'm trying to get a handle on the request, because, you know, we have commercial fisheries that could be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if there's stock there. Now, if we're only open 2 days a week for 12 hours, subsistence is provided. That's not that subsistence is closing or restricting the commercial fishery. And so I'm trying to get a little bit of a parameter here as to if we're getting to the place where we have scale backs. Let me ask Representative Johnson, if since the tiered kind of setup is that you restrict commercial fisheries first and then you close commercial fisheries, the restriction of commercial fisheries is happening all the time. So hopefully we wouldn't
If I might, let me try to, if I could get a report of the areas and the times when it's been ratcheted down to where commercial fishing was either shut down or curtailed severely, and that was ratcheted down to sports fishing, which was curtailed, that's kind of the number I'm looking at, kind of more the extreme, not cut back for a day or, you know, bag limits change, things like that. I just, once we get to the ratcheting where we're totally open, commercials closed, sports closed, or whatever the priority is, it may be reversed in some areas, down to subsistence only. That's the kind of report. I'm more looking at the extremes as opposed to just nipping at that ratcheting down. I'd like to know how many times in the last 5 years we've actually had to either close a fishery or severely restrict your fishery. I'm not wanting just daily closures or bag limit changes and stuff like that. I want more an extreme when sports fishing was either cut off or severely curtailed, and commercial fishing was cut off and severely curtailed, not just the tweaks, I think. Does that help?
And thank you, Representative Johnson. That does, because I, you know, oftentimes we're up here and we think, oh, well, here's a, and then if we're not constraining our report well enough, that then we can get into what you're not asking for,
right?
And so we want to make sure. So Representative Johannes,
just looking at the statute 16-05258, appears to be three levels. One, if the harvestable portion of the stock is sufficient to provide for all uses. two, if the portion of the stock is sufficient to provide for subsistence uses in some but not other uses, and then C, if the harvestable portion is sufficient to provide for subsistence use but no other uses. So it seems like there's three different levels in the statute here, so I'm not sure exactly how far, if we go to number two or number three, whether it restricts it a little bit or whether it completely shuts off other uses. So
from my perspective, I'd like to have it all.
Representative Johnson.
I think from my perspective, I'd like to have it all, but I think for reasonableness, I think we just get that third trigger in there where it's cut off for subsistence only, or severely curtailed. I think I'd like if a season was cut in you know, by two-thirds, I think that would be significant. So a significant change in the commercial sports fishing. But I would be satisfied with just the third trigger if it's been totally cut off, everything but subsistence.
Yeah, and I, Director Andrews, is it, before I go further, I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Wilson from the Hess Finance Subcommittee meeting. We're trying to make this a reasonable parameter. So do we get to the point of a closure of a commercial fishery or a restriction from within the sport fishery? Would that get us to a number, and would that definition of what we're looking for get us to something that would be reasonable to produce, do you think?
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer to that is yes. I think the directors of the other divisions, it's only going to be a handful. I mean, in one handful is my estimate. We've got the, you know, for example, the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, I'm familiar with. The Kwajak has had those kinds of situations. I'm not entirely sure of ones here in Southeast or other areas, but those would be examples since 2000.
Okay.
So I think we can do that. I did want to mention, too, that for Mr. Chairman, for everybody's information, I mean, subsistence, depending on the species, it's not open, particularly for salmon fisheries, it's not like it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's already restrictions. There might be, like, the regulations might be two 48-hour periods a week, for example. And as they're cut back in some of the other fisheries, those might be cut back to two 24-hour periods a week in subsistence and so forth, too. So there's always those considerations along the way that the managers make.
Okay, and I just wanted to, Representative Johansson, does that get to your level of satisfaction, and Representative Johnson?
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Great, thank you. And Representative Edgen.
So Elizabeth, then, if you went back to 1990, to follow up on Representative Johnson, Representative Johansson's questions and their request, the examples that this occurred probably could fit on both hands. The commercial and the sports fishing having to sort of give way, and then all you have left on the table is subsistence fishing. Is that an accurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgeman, I think yes.
And if I could just...
Representative Johnson, or Edgeman, follow-up. And then Representative Johnson.
Just as a follow-up, then, certainty to look at these circumstances, and they're all probably unique to each other, and they all have sort of different contextual background. I mean, the salmon bycatch in the high seas is an issue that is just getting more pronounced and getting bigger and bigger. We're looking at levels of bycatch that really are just going way and above the 10-year average. So that there in itself may have an impact on commercial and sports fishing, as it did in the Bristol Bay region last year and further up the river. The North Pacific Fishery Council is definitely working on that issue as we speak. So, you know, the context behind some of this, and we're just asking you to do a simple paper. You know, I may follow up on my own just to, if some of these catch my eye, and ask you to provide me a greater context of what was behind the closures.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one thing I want to be clear on, I'm interested in managing the fish, not what triggers something. So I think, you know, it's equally important is when subsistence has to be cut back. When that particular, because that would tell me that particular stock might be in danger. So that's what I'm looking. I'm looking at the stock, not necessarily who uses the fish. That's not at issue here. What I want to see is where we have potential problems in stocks. So another trigger might, in fact, be when subsistence was cut back. I mean, I think that might be the ultimate. You know, when we start to have to cut back the very bottom or the highest priority, that tells me that stock might have some difficulty. And that's what I'm looking for here, not necessarily what user group gets what. I want to be real clear that this is not a sports commercial versus subsistence thing. This is keeping fish in the river. That's the reason for my question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And you're fully comfortable with the conversation that is taking place, that you can develop a paper for us on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Little paper.
Thank you again. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, I think I've already covered this pretty much. Our core services are basically derived directly from our statutory mandate. It provides information directly into management by the department's fisheries managers, as we just discussed, and also for the allocation decisions that the Board of Fisheries makes. We also contribute to the fisheries management plans, and again, I just earlier described some that are in regulation. There's others that aren't, as well as to other management and allocation bodies, and these would be, for example, just as Representative Edgman mentioned, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, the International Pacific Halibut Commission, the U.S.-Canada-Yukon Salmon Panel, of which I'm the co-chair. I didn't know if you had any questions about that. I could perhaps answer those now or continue with this.
I have one. Are those research methodologies the same that you're using basically in Interior? I mean, are those either creel surveys or are they surveys of usage? How do you provide that information?
Well, it depends on the area and again, and where it's come from. And I was going to get in a little bit, describe, you know, our funding. Our funding is for the research part of what we do is largely from contracts and other entities. It's not from general fund. So depending on what's identified as needed by, for example, the Pacific Halibut Commission, the information that they might want on subsistence takes requires a different methodology than we might use if the Board of Fisheries wants information for ongoing management of salmon in Bristol Bay or the Kuskokwim, for example. So there may be different types of survey methodologies depending on what's needed.
When you're doing contracts like that, now let's say with the International Pacific Halibut Commission, do they basically ask you a question and you develop a, you know, a scientific survey method and then they review that and agree that that's the method that all they want to use? How does that kind of contractual basis work as far as asking the questions and looking at the survey where the science behind the method is going to be used?
Mr. Chairman, with the Halibut Commission, for example, they do have a review team of scientists that review what the questions are that we're proposing to ask, which they also have to run through Office of Management and Budget if it gets to some certain point that I'm not personally familiar with. But sometimes it does need to be run through the Federal Office of Management and Budget. And then also, they look at the overall methodology. So with the halibut, for example, they started regulations for subsistence halibut fishing, and they instituted a permit system, and they wanted to know what the take was. We're in the fifth year doing that research, but they wanted to know what the take was from each of 14,000 generally permit holders. So that's a little different methodology than we might use for 1,500 households along the Kuskokwim or Bristol Bay salmon permits or something like that. But it goes through a review process.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, as I said, our subsistence fishing research, and to summarize our division's main responsibilities, it's basically to conduct the research and document these subsistence uses, as identified in statute, estimate subsistence harvest levels, and to evaluate the potential impacts to subsistence uses from other uses. We do compile the information into different formats for the regulatory issues, and we provide it to the state and federal agencies as well as other researchers. We're also involved in baseline data collection so that we can evaluate trends over time. We're involved in one of the climate change studies right now with the Bering Sea Ecosystem project that the North Pacific Research Board has. We do resource development related impact studies, and you may remember last year I mentioned research we were doing under contract with Brand Associates on the Pebble Mine proposed development, and now there's a proposed expansion to the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, and we're subcontracting with Brand Associates for that work also on subsistence uses.
Before you go on, let me ask you a question. On the relationship with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, I mean, we've all been talking a little bit about the high incidental catch, the bycatch of king salmon. What kind of a role does your division have with the North Pacific Council or through ADF&G to the council? As far as looking at that as being problematic for subsistence fishing, or is that simply a stock assessment and stock measurement function that's going on now?
Mr. Chairman, it's generally the latter, what you described in the departments represented by the commissioner, as you know, on the council. So it comes into play there in terms of overall salmon production and so forth. The division, as a division, we haven't been except related to halibut and providing information to the folks that are staff to the council that are doing halibut harvest presentations and so forth. So our information feeds in that way. Aside from the division, as I mentioned, I'm the co-chair of the Yukon Salmon Panel, the U.S.-Canada one, and I'm the state's representative on that. And the panel we've written a number of letters, and we had some folks testify to the council about the salmon bycatch issue, and the panel's continuing to do that. That's largely because of the not knowing exactly how many are Yukon-bound salmon, and we have an international agreement. And as you may have heard this past season, the Canadian stocks, for some reason, weren't as productive as they had been. On the U.S. side, the Yukon stocks met their escapement, but the Canadian stocks didn't, and they had to cut back. And of course, we're interested in having more genetic stock identification information so that we can get as everybody is, it's not just Yukon stocks that are being taken in the bycatch, but to have a better estimate of what that might be and looking at alternatives for that reducing that bycatch.
And within the, if I remember right, the king salmon that are taken in that bycatch are retained, not for sale, but for distribution through food banks or something. Are genetic stock analysis by either observers or through that chain? Is that taking place to see what those, where those stocks come from that are in that high bycatch number?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question because I don't exactly know. I know that we do want to have industry more involved in getting samples, and I'm not exactly sure how much coverage there is, observer coverage there is on the boats, or if it varies by the size of the boats, as it does in some areas. So I'm afraid I'm not. We could get that information to you, but I'm not up on that.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. I mean, the Bering Sea boats are basically 100% observer coverage, but I was wondering whether the panel, if it's a concern for either Canadian subsistence or U.S. subsistence stock, if the panel had requested that genetic analysis of that bycatch.
We have been requesting it, and it. And again, it's for stocks to the Yukon for all uses, you know, not just for subsistence purposes. But we do have a treaty obligation to get a certain number of fish across the border. Okay, for just to move on to our program, our office and staff locations. As you know, we're a small organization. We have 25 full-time staff and 5 seasonal or part-time. We have 2 regional research programs. One is north of the Alaska Range with a regional office in Fairbanks and a field office in Kotzebue, and one south of the Alaska Range with a regional office in Anchorage and field offices in Dillingham and Juneau. The third part of our program is the information management program, which is the core for the data compilation, the analysis, and disseminating that information to the public as well as to others. Our current FY08 actual budget is $3.2 million. Nearly 50% of that is general funds and 50% from other funding sources. The general fund provides for program management and fixed costs and partially for the information management, but as I mentioned earlier, no research. So the other funding sources provide for the applied research that we do. Our targets and measures associated with our program.
Director Anders, Representative Wilson has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Elizabeth, so you get money from other sources for applied research, but only 45% of that is fisheries related. Can you give me some ideas of what the 55% that's not fisheries related is then?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, for example, migratory birds, marine mammals, comprehensive harvest surveys, which actually do include fisheries, are included in that other 55%, so it's not entirely non-fish. We have, for example, my role I think I included the Yukon Salmon Panel on the fisheries part. So it's birds, wildlife, comprehensive surveys, again, like the resource development ones with related to Pebble Mine and Red Dog, are included in the non-fish group.
I had a question.
Representative Johansson.
I noticed under Major's report and disseminate results to the public and to the agencies, how do you use your departmental public information officer? I think he's in the room here. Do you take advantage of the funding that we provide for that position? How do you use the public information officer within the department with your division?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, the funding that I'm talking about here is all research related, and it's for us to disseminate the technical reports, get things posted on the web, and so forth. In terms of the public information officer, it's service relative to the legislative body. News releases, for example, we had some news releases this past summer related to the Yukon salmon and concerns about border passage and whatnot. So that's more in the public press release type things as well and so forth. And we also have a communications person who puts together articles that go into a couple of newsletters that the department has that are online ones, and usually there's a subsistence types study in that. We don't write those, but we provide the information to those folks on that.
So you're putting Tim to work. He has value to your division.
He does, Mr. Chairman.
I'm picking on him. I'm just
Representative.
I'm sure he'll appreciate when you have him come up to the table too. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, just to continue, you know, our targets and measures are associated, as you can see on your slide, is with conducting the studies and gathering the information. I try to balance it across all regions of the state. We analyze, as I mentioned earlier, the regulatory proposals to the Board of Fisheries as well as game. And we report on that at those meetings. We report and disseminate the results. We're involved in the management planning of the different divisions, and then the information management, which is a database, which I'll talk about here shortly.
Thank you, Ann. We had talked earlier for those members of the committee that hadn't been here about surveys. And there's been some interest in the past on the survey methodologies and all. And I was wondering if you'd indicated you could supply us with an example of one of those kinds of surveys. So will you be able to do that, not here today, of course, but to get a copy of it doesn't have to be a current survey, just so that we can see what kind of methodology and what kind of reporting comes out of those surveys.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned, and as we talked about a few minutes ago, it depends on the study. It depends on the contractor and so forth. One example that I can provide to you that's very current is one we're undertaking related to the expansion of the Red Dog Mine. And that had to be coordinated with folks associated with the proposed mine expansion, as well as I think we had somebody from U.S. Department of Agriculture, because there's some food security related questions, the comprehensive baseline information that the contractor Brondon Associates required. So sometimes there's a suite of questions that are required by the contractor. And of course we try to have consistency across our surveys so that we can track changes across time.
That would be great. So we'll look forward to that. Just send it to my staff, committee staff, Mr. Flora.
Okay, you bet. Mr. Chairman, for the FY09 budget request and some of our key challenges, looking forward, we have two increments you'll see in the governor's budget and a CIP request to ensure that we do meet our core services, and these are predominantly related to fisheries management. One is to get our subsistence salmon harvest database accessible to managers, researchers, and the public by making it web accessible and to have it integrated into the database and format used by the fisheries managers in commercial fisheries division. We want to also be able to continue to provide an annual statewide report of the subsistence salmon harvest.
Okay, and thank you. And Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you. Elizabeth, how do you do it now? I mean, how do you get that information to them now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, right now we have the salmon harvest information in a database, but it's in Excel and Access, and it's not web accessible. So it takes additional time in order to physically get the information and get the parts that they need and get it sorted in a certain way that they can have it. when it's becomes web accessible, it'll be converted so people can sort it the way that they want, get the information by an area pretty quickly, how they want it. Commercial fisheries has already been doing that with their own data related to commercial fisheries, and so we'd use the same portal so that that data set is right there, and whether it's department staff who need ready access or the public or other folks, it would be web accessible, which is kind of the, I mean, if you look at, for example, let's see, it used to be Department of Community and Regional Affairs is in Commerce now. Sorry, I was gone when they made that change. Their database for community information is a good example, I think, of web accessibility. You can quickly go to any community or several sets of communities and get the population data or economic information. So it would be similar for the salmon harvest database.
Representative Johansson?
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, that's okay. I was just checking my notes.
Just two things. Moving over to the web, to the electronic information, we were in State Affairs the other day talking to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Is it the intent to get the information from the ground, from the users, entered into an electronic database, or is this information that we're going to be having folks in Fish and Game sit there all day and do data entry? I mean, is there a push towards having direct information right into the database, or are we going to be looking for increments for people to sit there all day and enter information into the database?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, I'm glad you're thinking forward. I mean, I like the paperless idea. We're not there with the subsistence division yet. Just trying to get it web accessible would be an important step for us. So it does involve some data entry clerks that we have to enter the data. How we would, you know, we don't have like an e-landing type system yet for subsistence, and how that might be accomplished or when is actually, it'd be kind of fun to work on a group to figure that out. I personally would be interested, but we've got other challenges in rural areas where there's not necessarily the internet or electronic capability that there is in the more populated areas.
Follow up, Representative Johansson.
You led right into my next comment. Representative Foster had talked about the challenges of getting that database from rural Alaska through a computer network. So I understand that there must be some manual information, but I would glad to hear that you're thinking ahead as well and hope you put that wish into motion and do what you can to make it as paperless and data entry less as possible. Thank you.
Great.
Okay. The second increment is to be able to annually assess and evaluate the fish harvests and trends, particularly in Bristol Bay and southeast in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And then also to continue ongoing harvest monitoring studies. At this point, we're not in a situation where, even though we have these data in different databases, to be able to have a research analyst, for example, really go through and evaluate what the trends are. And to determine, as we know, I mean, there have been changes in some areas, and there may be opportunities for other fisheries, for example, and we just, until we can actually have some money to analyze the data in that way, we aren't ready to identify those, but we think it's important to be able to do so. We get questions from the Board of Fisheries, for example, that will say, well, why is this going on in the extreme upper Kuskokwim and these changes going on? And we haven't really had a chance to evaluate that information. We know there's been changes, and we know there's been, in some areas, declines that aren't related to abundance. There's other things happening in some of these communities. The third is a CIP request, which is to integrate the technical and scientific reporting into the, again, the department's online accessible publication systems. The two fisheries divisions have already accomplished this. Sport Fish Division took the lead on that and got it up and going, and Commercial Fisheries has been doing it the last couple of years, and I think all of theirs are now in that system. We've been trying to format all of our reports accordingly to match that, and so we have a request to be able to then get the information exactly the same and just as accessible, so all of the fisheries related reports a person can get through a single portal. And then lastly, it's important to maintain our own capacities in terms of staffing, information management, and with joint fisheries management. And I know that you heard from the other directors, and I'm sure not just in this department, about recruitment and retention challenges. And I guess lastly, it's essential for us for information management, because they really are the ones that it's almost like the engine. I mean, they compile all the information. They're the ones that get it back out to the other folks. But we need to make sure that those staff are retained. They carry a lot of knowledge with them, and we need to maintain that capacity. So then, I know you've been asking questions along the way, but if there's any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson, then Representative Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have two questions. On your increments, how much is one question. And the second question is in retention and hiring and retention. I found in many departments there are requirements that you must have served a certain amount of time within the department. Is your department one of those where some of the requirements for advancement or hiring requires that you be in the department for a certain period of time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there's not a requirement to have been in the department. It's the function of the job classification that you're in that you've had to perform at a that same level wherever it may have been. It could have been in the private sector. We do get folks that have actually come from the private sector or federal agencies or just relevant experience that matches the class specification.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
And is there an education trade-off to that?
It depends on the position. You've probably heard that from other folks, too. I mean, some of them, it can be just from experience. It depends on what level you're at. And others, there'll be a basic, like a bachelor's degree required and, you know, 1 or 2 years of experience. Or if you have a master's degree, it may be only 1 year of experience and not 2 years of experience required.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
This is more of a statement. I think in so many departments, we're hamstringing ourselves with the ability to go out and hire people because we have requirements that they must have a certain amount of experience. And we're doing things that are very unique here. I'm not sure where else you could go and get the kind of experience that we have here. So we're kind of in a situation where the only way you can ever advance or to get hired is to be in the department. And I want to see that if we go out and get some educated people that have a desire to work, that they're not excluded. Or when they go on the website to say, I can't qualify, I may have a master's or a doctorate, I can't qualify because I don't have 2 years experience in this field. I certainly understand experience, but also understand that we are in a situation where we are having a drain on our workforce and those highly qualified, highly specialized people. The experience level just simply isn't going to be there. So I encourage you to take a look at that. And I know the Department of Administration is also looking at that to remove some of those restrictions that require a certain amount of infield experience, especially if some that say in the department. There are some departments that you must have it in the department. And those are the kind of things I'd like to see looked at and evaluated and made sure that they're entirely appropriate for hiring people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I agree entirely and have been working towards that. I've been working with the human resources staff to revise the wording for minimum qualifications. Apparently, I don't have to go through a whole lot of hoops to do that so that I can broaden the base of interest, as you point out, and have more than a couple of people applying. And I think it's exactly, I mean, we've found that what you're talking about, they read even just the description, and it's, I know there's a lot of other people that are capable of doing the work, but just to read the description, they would self-eliminate. So I've been trying to work on that type of change, and have been, actually. You also asked about the increments. The first increment for the database accessibility is $156,000. You'll see that in the paperwork. And then the second increment for the evaluating the harvest assessment data and so forth for fisheries, $142.8 for that one.
And the capital?
And the capital.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Trying to see exactly. Trying to remember exactly what that one is. I think it's around $140,000. I don't have it jot down right in front of me, but it's thereabouts.
And Director Andrews, that capital was for.
It's for the technical publications database integration with the department's publication online publication system.
Okay. Following up on, you have the same issue we're doing. Following up on Representative Johnson's question about hiring, what is your division's basic experience in the last year or so as far as being able to hire the folks that you need to hire for the division? Are you having problems, any more problem than you had for the last 4 years? What's basically out there as far as the people applying for your division?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it a lot of it is just having the description so that you can get people who aren't self-selecting themselves out of it and to make those changes. So, I mean, we've had difficulties. I mean, we just get one or two applicants for a position. That's one problem, and so I've identified a solution to that. Another one is having the descriptions of the job qualifications written so that, for example, we've had some difficulty working with the administration and the HR folks because their reading of what the job qualification requirements or the minimum requirements are is different than we might have. So that, for example, ours is kind of broad. It'll say something like social science or closely related field, and they're interpreting that so narrowly that people who have a lot of expertise in even the education, for example, we had a Northern Studies master's student from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and HR was telling us that that person didn't meet the minimum qualifications, and yet that's exactly the kind of program that that's designed for. So then we have to go through an appeal process. That delays the time. They understand. So some of it's, you know, I mean, they have their own challenges with staffing. But it delays the time for us, and what has often happened is people are looking for several jobs. You know, I mean, they're out looking at a number of jobs, and we've lost, by the time we get through the appeals, we lose the top candidate or even the top two candidates. So the time is an issue, and also, as I said, just the number of applicants. And then lastly, as I know, I believe Director Hilsinger mentioned too, is losing folks to a federal program that where the, you know, the salary and so forth is, you know, considerably higher.
So, following up on that, so you're, I know in the first year after the change was made to integrate HR, you're still experiencing, it sounds like, the same kind of problems of efficiencies and coordination with the unitized HR instead of having the hiring ability within your division?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I wouldn't say that because they've been tremendous support to me. I mean, they're right there when I call them. It's just that some of the structural things about no matter where they are, how it's set that they operate, and changes that we can make, and getting those made. You know, they're certainly willing and able and offer really good suggestions and can help us with it. But it's just identifying those things and then getting through those hoops. So I don't personally haven't had any problems with the restructuring, I guess, is what it is that was done, because they've been tremendous service to me. So some of it's just the way some of these other things are set up with the class specifications, the MQs, and so forth. That's what's difficult.
Okay, and are you finding that, I know earlier when this transpired, that the actual administrative cost or the interagency receipt coming out of your budget, how does that kind of still compare? Has it gotten down to a more reasonable level, or is it still higher? More expensive to have that integrated hiring than it was to have the have that within the division?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that because I wasn't involved at this level of hiring when I worked for the state before, so I'm not really familiar with that part of it.
Okay, you can see where we're trying to get some information. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
We'll go and continue on with people that might have that. Thank you, Representative Edgman, for waiting for that. Go ahead.
See if I remember my question now. if I remember last year's discussion, it seems like it was approximately a year ago today, my time goes by, about the subsistence division and what we just talked about today. The role of the division really is more support service-related, analysis, information service, crunching of data, surveys, and things like that. And I remember we talked last year about the name of the subsistence division maybe being more of a misnomer than really what it could be if it were to accurately portray what the division in fact does. But has there been any further discussion on maybe renaming the division or titling it so it's a little more accurate of what the division does?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgman, I mean, I did discuss it with my management team as well as with other staff that might have been interested in the discussion, you know, and I mean, while we think the name Division of Subsistence reflects, you know, what's in the statute, which is, you know, subsistence, you know, in all aspects, I mean, there's no question, though, that the focus is on research. In my view, something more descriptive like Division of Subsistence Research then would make that clear. And so we don't have a problem with that change, and I understand, you know, it can be an administrative one. It doesn't need to go through the legislature or anything. That's a change that we could make, and if the desire's there to do that, we could do that. And certainly the other divisions have changed their names over the years too, from, you know, Division of Commercial Fisheries Management and Development when they included the old Fred Division, and then went back to Division of Commercial Fisheries and Division of Game and Division of Wildlife Conservation. It changes. So we'd certainly be agreeable to that change if that's a desire.
Representative Edgman, follow up or another question?
Yeah, I wasn't, just to follow up, I wasn't expressing it as a desire. I guess I was asking, you know, whether the department, you know, obviously it sounds like you have discussed it and you've considered it, but I guess it's not necessary enough that you've actually done it to this point, and so that's where I was going with my question.
At one time, Mr. Chairman, our division, in the statute, it says division of hunting, shall establish a division of subsistence hunting and fishing. So I think that was almost less useful there, but that's kind of.
Well, possibly if you decide to do it, you could do it when there's a letterhead change or something, so it doesn't become a financial burden.
And you run out of paper. You run out of letterhead.
Well, we really appreciate your presentations. Are there more questions? Yes, Representative Johnson has a further question.
Two, actually. First of all, you brought up the, I probably wouldn't even have asked you, but you brought up the genetic identifiers for the distinguishing between the Canadian or the different runs. I'm just wondering what the level of identification on the genetics is, and the reason I ask is when we start talking about genetics and where the fish come from, that makes me awfully nervous because that gets into discrete stock management, which might work differentiating between Alaska fish and Canada fish. But when it trickles down into individual streams and managing on a discrete stock management level, do you know what the level of genetic identifiers, how deep that will go? This may be a question for the comp fish and sport fish people, but you brought it up, so I'm going to ask you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johanson, they would be the best people to ask that question. In terms of the agreement with Canada, our requirement is to get a certain number of fish across the border. And then it's for the Canadians to be concerned about, you know, the specific streams that fish are from and so forth. But from our standpoint and the agreement, it's to get the fish across the border. And we can, you know, when they do genetic stock identification from samples near the mouth of the river, they can tell what are Canadian stocks, just as a group Canadian stocks from other Yukon stocks.
Just makes follow up, Representative Johanson.
Just makes me pay close attention. We had a piece of legislation in the 90s concerning discrete stock management, and it became quite a controversial issue. So just caught my eye. Can I switch gears for just a second?
Yes, another question, Representative Johnson.
Again, last year when we had you guys up here, we talked about the different areas that the federal government decides are either rural or non-rural. And, of course, one of my communities, Saxman, was delisted. And I just want to get a refresher. When does the Division of Subsistence decide that they're going to challenge or question a federal decision? Is it a squeaky wheel method, or do you review each instance for the accuracy of the federal government, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johanson, that's done by the department as a whole. I mean, the liaison team will evaluate that, discuss it with the commissioner, and then determine which ones we're going to challenge.
And, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johanson.
Obviously, you must have a seat at that table. I think you must have some input on what's considered subsistence and not, since you're the Division of Subsistence.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johanson, yes, we would. I'm in terms of, you know, the federal decision making. I mean, we have challenged their process on their rural non-rural review. I mean, we've undertaken that as a whole. We've also and that was submitted. Let's see, this past July, we challenged specifics, and we also challenged it as a whole, as the state.
Follow-up, Representative Johanson.
So I could just repeat that back to you. The whole process in itself, you have challenged, and individual decisions, you have challenged, and the Saxman decision is one that you reviewed and decided that you would not challenge. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johanson, we didn't review the Saxman one specifically.
if I may.
Representative Johann.
So you don't review every decision. So the Saxman one possibly could have something in there that you don't agree with, yet it hasn't been reviewed, so it's just standing as a decision without any pushback from the state or review?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, that's correct. It's part of the general package of challenging the process that they went through on that. And we could have that brought to the commissioner's attention for further examination and or some examination of Saxman specifically, if you'd like.
I thought I made that clear last year, but apparently I didn't, so thank you.
On that point, Director Andrews, would that be something that an individual legislator would take and request of the commissioner, or is that would that go through your essentially research department? Or I mean, it seems like that decision, I think what we need to do is get a little better feeling of what would be the process that that challenge would or that request for challenging that decision, what would be the appropriate way in which that is done?
Mr. Chairman, that would be through the commissioner.
Okay, so that would be directly to the commissioner. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Johansson.
I think it should be in the charge of the department to review all decisions that affect Alaskans that are made by the federal government. And I don't necessarily believe, although I have no problem sticking my fingers in there, I think it's something that the department needs to review all of those decisions that are made by the federal government that impact our citizens. And you know, I'd be happy to start stirring things up, but I think it's better coming from the department than it is from an individual legislator. I think that should be part of their charge.
And Representative Johansson, I agree with you. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't talking to the wrong person to make that request, and that I think that it is probably the commissioner. I just wanted to make sure if that was correct. I believe that we last year passed a new commission or board. I think it passed through the House. I think it passed through the Senate and was signed as well, so that we have a commission that is specifically set up to review and challenge those impacts with the Federal Wildlife and Fisheries Management.
Advisory Commission.
Yeah, and so I think that might be another aspect that we might not want to ignore, since we just set that up last year. But I just wanted to make sure that we weren't mentioning that at this level with the division director, who is basically in research, and expect that the research division would accomplish that for us. So I'm not at all challenging or disagreeing with your assessment. Director Andrews.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, I mean, last year, I mean, I did pass on that request to the person who was the special assistant dealing with the state federal issues. So it's not that I didn't transmit that. I mean, it did go to the person that whose charge it is to look into that, and I can pass it on to the person who's now in that position and have her give you a call to talk about your specific questions and concerns and to address that. And so,
yeah, I didn't mean, Mr. Chairman, that
we have to.
I wasn't going there. It's just, you know, sounds like somebody's new in the position and things fall through the cracks. But I was curious last year. It'd be nice to know.
Sure, you bet. I'll have the person contact you.
Representative Johnson, did you have something further? Is anyone else in the committee? We really appreciate your coming and updating us on this. We'll look forward to a sample of the survey, and if there's anything else that comes up that we need to be aware of, we would hope that you would you know, inform us through the liaison, and we could take that up at a fisheries committee meeting, and we appreciate it. One thing I did want to say is that this is Martin Luther King Day. We are doing our normally a holiday for us. You know, obviously the diversity within our state, the diversity that your division deals with. I know that we have a large Old Believer Russian community in the fisheries in my neck of the woods. There are also subsistence and commercial and sport activities within from the native community within my and everyone else's, I believe, district as well, and we appreciate that, and we appreciate your being able to come here on this essentially holiday to come and share with us those aspects of the division. So if there's nothing else further, we will be adjourned today.
Thank you.
And it's 10 o'clock.